I would like to introduce our three distinguished speakers this afternoon, whom we're very, very happy to have with us. And what I propose to do is that I will introduce each one of them, then each separately will have their paper for about 20 minutes or so, then I will introduce the second one, and so on. I won't take questions after each speaker's presentation, but if you could treasure your questions, I'm hoping that we will have time for them at the end. Well, if I could first turn to Professor Lalaji Bowne. She studied history at Oxford and then went to Africa, where she taught at a really wide range of universities in Ghana, Uganda, Zambia, and three different universities in Nigeria. She became a Commonwealth visiting professor in the University of Edinburgh as long ago as 1974. And in 75, she was given an honorary doctorate at the Open University for her services to the education of the underprivileged. She was the first woman to achieve the award of a William Pearson Tolley Prize from Syracuse University in the States. In 1981, she returned to Britain to a professorship in the Department of Adult and Continuing Education, from which so many of the organizers and speakers have come at this to this conference today. In 2002, having been professor for many years, this university, Glasgow, gave her an honorary D.Litt, Doctor of Letters. She's been important, I think, for commending governments, which the West has not usually commended very much or even recognized for their educational achievements. Cuba, for example, Tanzania under Nyerere, Bangladesh. And she's linked this up to their preparedness to place core centrally allocated public funding into this. In recent years, she's been well known, as many of you will realize, for her championing of women's rights to education, pointing out inconvenient facts like, she has also published numerous books, amongst them Education in the Commonwealth, The First 40 Years, Maintaining Universal Primary Education, Lessons from the from Commonwealth Africa, Women's Literacy for Development, African Adult Education, and the one I think which has a really lovely title, A Rusty Person is Worse Than a Rusty Iron, Adult Education. So I'd like to ask Lalaji when she'll come and speak to us, or sit there and speak to us.
Well, with such friends, who needs enemies? I wrote three or four lines in your document thinking that was sufficient, but I'm very touched. Thank you, Bridget. I want to be, you see, I made a summary, but I want to relate it to what's happened today. And before I get on to that, I want to start with a cautionary tale. All these governments got together for Education for All and the Millennium Development Goals. And our government, the Westminster government, I think we can be quite proud of, that they committed through DFID £1 billion, which was to be used for the promotion of education and literacy between now and 2015. Now we have a government that is deciding whether to honor those commitments entered into and to do away with the ones which they think will cause the least outcry if they do away with them. That's their criterion. If it's something that they think there will be a huge outcry, like the Gurkhas, they'll stick to it. If it's something like education and literacy, they don't think there'll be a huge public outcry, so they're likely to ditch it. And I think that's a very important lesson for us to think of. I was shocked when I saw that this document was leaked. It was the briefing for the Secretary of State, and it showed least likely to cause a public outcry, and it included education and literacy. And I think in a way we can see this, because if we ask ourselves, how many radio programs, how many newspaper supplements, how many newspaper articles there were this week about international literacy in this country? Any? None. And so I think we're sitting here fired up, and I'm not trying to be depressing, but I'm just trying to fire us up more, because we mustn't stick in our own little cocoon. We have to get out there among other people and try and get them to understand what this is about. Otherwise, all our efforts, whether in Scotland, whether in the UK, whether in the wider world, are going to be dissipated, and we're going to be disillusioned and frustrated. I wouldn't want that to happen, and I don't think it will, because I think all of us here are more determined than that. But I think we have to notice these inconvenient factors, as Bridget said. Otherwise, we may be too complacent. So I wanted to start with that. Now then, my jumping off point is to do with the international commitments and percepts. Old as I am, I remember I was alive and kicking, quite kicking, when the United Nations Charter was signed in San Francisco. Through the years, I've witnessed all the different international documents about education and about literacy. And we have all our governments have at one time or another signed up to the idea that there should be a public obligation to literacy skills, and starting with the idea that literacy is a human right, a human right. And for many, the facilitation of literacy has involved other concepts like human development, social justice, empowerment, and transformation. I'm going to say something about empowerment again in a minute. I think I better say a word about transformation, because ultimately that's our goal. But again, I think we have to underline, transformation is not like in the pantomime, that the curtain goes up and everybody is suddenly in their spangled tights. Transformation in societies or communities, whether communities in a geographical area or communities of interest across areas in this global world, these things will take time, and we have to have patience and a long view and not imagine it's going to happen tomorrow. And don't get disconcerted. I'm old enough, I think I can say this, Bounds homely saying that, you know, you can live a long life and you can still not see everything happen that you hoped would happen. But the point is that transformation is an ideal which we work towards. But I think that empirical observation and research does give us some justification for associating literacy with all these things, with social justice, and I want to come back to that, with development and so on, whether in this country or in the wider world. And one of the declarations which was made by the international community, which I rather like because I think it is realistic but also inspiring, is something called the Declaration of Persepolis. And in 1975, the nations of the world came together to make a declaration about literacy. Adama knows this very well, all these, very familiar. And in a way, it was a pity we lost the Shah, because he was rich enough to give us a huge amount of money for literacy work. So, however, there we are. But I'm afraid Mr. Ahmadinejad is not helping us in the same way. But the serious point is, this is what they said, and I think, and I put it in my summary, so it's there for you. Literacy, like education in general, is not the driving force of historical change. It is not the only means of liberation, but it is an essential instrument for all social change. And I think we have to accept, and we all believe this, I think that's why we're in this game, that some variety of literacy is an essential component of any strategy for change and development, whether it's in Scotland or whether it's in Tanzania, or whether it's in Peru, or wherever it happens to be. And I think we can accept that there is a liberating capacity in literacy. And again, we see this from empirical observation and research. And while we have different arguments about the meaning of the word empowerment, to me, I just want to give two brief illustrations, one empirical and one research-based. One is a story which I used last year in my international literacy lecture when I was in Uganda and I came to a place where there were some widows who'd braved bandit country to come to their class. They didn't. There was no chairs because nobody had money for chairs, so they were all sitting on the ground or on logs. And there was no money for pens or pencils or anything like that. So they were just writing with sticks in the mud. It was wet. And I thought to myself, foolishly, I should by that time have learned better, what a pointless exercise. Then I went and I was looking over the shoulder of one of these women and she wrote her name and I looked at it and I said, oh, Lucy. The expression on that woman's face that I had given her an identity from something she had written was something so transformative for her that it really made me understand how important it is, even if it's a stick in the mud, it not stick in the mud, but a stick in the mud, that it can be a hugely important personal effect. And whereas empowerment is not the same as emancipation, empowerment does mean people get a new kind of confidence that they never had before. And to refer to research, some of you will know the work of Nelly Stromquist in Latin America, and she has done systematic research with women's groups in Latin America, and again has seen how these women, how their whole outlook has changed by the fact that they've had access to some form of literacy, that they're able to report. We now feel ready to take part in public functions. Before, we just used to, when the men said to us, go and look after your pots and pans, we went to look after our pots and pans. But we now know that we have the right to leave our pots and pans and join with the men in some of the things they're doing as well. So that is the Declaration of Persepolis reminding us that literacy is an important component for social change, and part of social change includes these elements, like empowerment in the most basic sense of enabling people to have a self-confidence that they didn't have before. And I don't know why it is, but just the fact of being able to identify something in writing, which is not just between you talking to your neighbor, just does seem to have a really amazing impact. Now that leads me on to my first, I want to make three main points, and having started from Persepolis. And my first main point is something that some of us were in discussion groups talking about this morning, and that's the relationships of literacies within education. And I do want to underline this. It may seem boring and trite and a truism, but we have constantly to try and remind others, even if we know it well ourselves, that literacies sit within the framework, as Adama reminded us, of lifelong education. Literacies are a continuum themselves, but they're within the larger continuum. And we have to keep saying this, and I think we have to keep emphasizing that. And by the way, Bridget just said that last year I led a team on a book about universal primary education. And many countries in Africa got very close to universal primary education in the time of President Nyerere and Nkrumah and co. And then it all backslid. Now, there were various reasons. One of the reasons was because there wasn't what we call a literate environment. People who have been to a literacy class themselves and have understood literacy and value literacy, they then value school education and see the importance of sending their children to school and not just thinking it's a waste of time. And I've seen that in many environments in this country as well as elsewhere. It's particularly important, I think, in the case of women, that when women understand what literacy means, then they have an enthusiasm to send their daughters to school. That means their daughters will maybe be not exposed to her, and the women understand this once they've got the beginnings of literacy. Their daughters are not going to be exposed to harmful practices like female genital mutilation. And it is very interesting how FGM is now beginning to be swept away by some of these women who've gotten education and understand it. If girls go to school and the women understand this, it means they won't be married at 14 because they'll continue with their schooling until later time. So there are reasons, very dramatic reasons that I've cited, but also less dramatic ones, whereby literacy for the adult feeds back to the school. And then secondly, and it's obvious to all of us, And we know this, and this goes back, I think, to Ralph Sinclair's report, that, you know, we associate poor schooling with deprivation and so on, and it's partly because deprivation includes an environment with no books or no computers or no mobile phone or whatever. And the children of people who are in those environments do not have the chance to make the best use of the education. However able they are, they don't have the chance. So, and we have to keep underlining this, because so many of our pastors and masters think it's an either or. Okay, we've got this budget, and all of you who work in local authorities are going to face this. They're going to say, well, we've got to keep the schools going. We're going to give up on the adult literacy side. And we have to try and make them understand that if they abandon the adult literacy, they're going to flaw and vitiate the schooling, and the things have to go together. And I think we also have to make them understand that it is a continuum. I always find it amazing that you see something like the American Army. All their officers spend something like 20% of their working life in continuing education. And yet people grudge some poor soul having 10 weeks to learn how to read or whatever. Well, people who already are privileged, they know the value of continuing education. And we have to make them see that it's equally important for people who are less privileged than themselves. We all do have to learn more things through life, and you can see at my age, and I can't resist telling you this, I had, of course, to face the idea of computers rather later than many of my younger colleagues, and I was quite pleased with myself. I had a young man to try and show me the basics, and we started out very well, as I thought, and as he left, he stood by the door and he said, you know, for an old person, you're quite intelligent. Well, as if that wasn't enough of a put down, he then said, maybe it's because you're a professor. Well, I was lucky. I could afford to pay to go through the continuum. Others can't. So the point I'm making is we have to continue to keep hammering this thing that there is a trade-off between out-of-school literacy and in-school performance and achievement. The second main point I want to make moves on from this. That, you see, is about policy. This is now coming to be about social justice. And I think it is true to say that in the 21st century, people without appropriate literacy skills are always going to be at a social disadvantage. Needn't be so in the past. You know, if you go back to the days of Robert the Bruce and co, it was land and sword play which got you power. But in the 21st century, you can't get any access to any form of power without literacy. And I think this is something to bear in mind. You have to come to grips with people who govern you, and all the people who govern us are literate, and they want us to do literate things, like as Mr. Mann was saying this morning, Mr. Cross was saying this morning, that we have to fill in the census forms. We also have to fill in birth certificates. And I have horrible stories. Oh, I've got to wind up. I must move on. Let me just quickly say then about social imbalance, that social imbalance is unhealthy for society. And I want to, I'm sorry because I haven't got on to my core. You see, here we are, but Isa's quite right. Let me just say that any of you who haven't read Wilkinson and Pickett, the spirit level, which actually says, and it's true, that societies which are less equal do worse than societies which are more equal. So I think there's a social justice argument for literacy work. I wanted to say something more about women and literacies. Maybe it'll come out in discussion. Just to wind up, I've talked about literacy and culture. And this is something that somebody said at the back about the Scots language, that if people are exposed to literacy which relates to their own cultural background, they're more likely to make better use of it and to become more creative in general than if they're just expected to have some kind of one-size-fits-all conversation. And I think that's all I have to say. I just want to go back to Persepolis and say, let us never forget that although literacy, we mustn't overclaim for it, it can't do everything, but without literacy, there will not be social justice, there will not be a change in the unbalance of society, and women especially will continue to be disadvantaged.
Thank you very much indeed, Lalaji. As usual, a very pithy and illuminating set of comments.